Beep, 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 beep.
Hello and welcome to episode 002 or 0002 if we're feeling kind of frisky of WTF Tech Podcast. My name is Darren Duke. I am one of the three co-hosts along with Stuart McIntyre and Jesse Gallagher. Good morning and good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Darren. Good to chat to you again.
Good morning.
And Jesse, how are you?
I'm doing all right.
Well, let me rephrase that. I won't ask that question. We'll bleep that out.
It's been a rough old week in the US, isn't it? We're not going to go too much into those topics, but goodness me, you guys have been through the mill.
It's like 1776 all over again.
And you can't blame us this time, either.
No, yeah. And again, I'm an Englishman on the wrong side. Okay, moving right along. One of the things that did actually come out of the election, indirectly, that we're going to talk about, is the idea of fake news. And its general impact on, if it didn't affect the election, you know, what is the principles behind publishing fake sites with just the opportunity to lie and deceive people? You know, I'm kind of shocked. And we do have freedom of the press and free speech over here, which means they're completely legit and above board. But there has been a bit of kickback this week in the technology industry. Stuart, what do you think?
Well, I guess what's changed is that we've always had, I guess, fake news or incorrect news or inaccurate news. But what's changed is the way it's being publicized and, you know, escalated via viral social media and everything else. And that's the challenge, is it goes with the echo chamber, is that somebody posts something that's an untruth, and then, you know, other people see the headline and repost it without fully fact-checking. And we see this all the time, don't we, with various things, you know, to do with health alarms and other things. And yet this time with the election, it just seems to have been raised to an entirely new level. And it's quite scary. And I think this is just the first real time it's hit the headlines. But I imagine that it's going to, you know, come back to bite us every time there's a referendum or an election or anything, and unless the social media sites like Facebook and Twitter and so on can get on top of it. But then how do you do that whilst also maintaining the freedom of the press and the freedom of us to publish information? It's a tough problem to solve.
Yeah, and I did find it interesting that Mark Zuckerberg came out and said, well, no one believes what we post anyway. And someone tweeted, you might want to tell that to your advertisers.
Yeah, and it does seem to be a real dichotomy, doesn't it? Is one minute they're telling advertisers the power of Facebook, and the next minute saying, "Oh, it has no impact, really." You don't think that they can maintain that stance for too long.
Yeah, and I mean, like, certainly, you know, like you were saying, that the notion of fake news or propagandistic news is nothing new. You know, there's the old quote, a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. And that, you know, much like many other things, it's like technology pours gasoline on that fire, essentially. Like, you know, it's one thing when there's, you know, a slanted bit of news in newspapers going around becoming popular. And there's another thing when, you know, somebody sees that, you know, like, you know, oh, Hillary Clinton is super sick, or, you know, Trump kills Hobo or something. And it's like, oh, yeah, I like that, retweet or share on Facebook. And it's like, just boom, and you can just do it. And then there's like essentially no effort whatsoever in seeing something that you are predisposed to like, and then essentially sharing that with all of your friends who may or may not believe it. But then some of them are going to, and like there's no work involved in that, essentially, for you. And, you know, other than the various like kind of telltale signs on the articles themselves, like, you know, one of the things that with Facebook certainly is just that, you know, something from abcnews.com has the same visual priority as something from abcnews.com.co, which is just, you know, outright lying. But visually, it's like you have to kind of look for that kind of grayscale.co to say, hey, wait, maybe this is not even the real thing. But, you know, that's just the way the system works. Everything is basically on the same baseline. And so it makes it that much easier for either outright lies like the, you know, the .co fake, fake knockoff news, or the just like kind of super slanted stuff where it's like, you know, one of my bugaboos lately has been, you know, something just happened that confirms your belief and your political enemies are pissed. And it's like, well, that's garbage. But it's so easy to share, and it just it's right in line with everything else at the exact same priority level, essentially.
And this has been such a circus that I think it's hard to actually tell if something's fake. you know, one of the candidates has said some outrageous things, and if you see that that candidate has been quoted as saying something even outrageous, it's not a surprise. You're like, oh, that might be real. You know, it used to be so much simpler to say real or not real. And now I think it's very, very difficult because all the norms have been bypassed this cycle. And I think for every cycle going forwards now.
And it's tough to know how to kind of overcome it as an individual, because you see something is not true, and you know, you can add a comment or something to somebody share, but you know, that's not going to reach the, you know, the mass that's behind some of these news articles. And if you ever delve into the comment threads on the articles themselves, they so rapidly get into, you know, name calling and you know, just vitriol really, that I'm not sure that that's a good place for any of us to spend any time trying to fight this kind of thing. So it has to happen, I think, at a layer above the individual, doesn't it? It has to be either the, you know, the communication medium or else some other kind of organization that can step in. But again, you then so rapidly get into, you know, control over the media, which I don't think any of us want. But it's hard to know how do you maintain the freedom whilst also controlling the you know, the nasty stuff. And I think the other thing that made this such a impactful time for all of this to happen is the fact it was such a extreme versus extreme election, wasn't it? It's you had, you know, again, we don't get into the party politics of all this, but you had two such extreme views. And I think the same thing was true with Brexit in the UK, is that the minute you get, you know, roughly 50% of the population against 50%, you know, of the population, you're going to get these two extremes coming out. Whereas it's in a normal election cycle, particularly in the UK, where you tend to have three or four parties involved, you don't get quite that same, you know, elements coming to the public view. So the other thought I had was, are we ever likely to see this impacting within organisations? You know, so much of the way we work with each other or communicate with each other, like outside via Facebook or Twitter and that, it's being mimicked inside organisations, isn't it, with social collaboration, enterprise social networks. Are we ever going to get a situation where people are sharing, you know, incorrect information and then that kind of becoming viral across an organization? I guess you're always going to have controls in place that can stop that happening, but it does worry me a little bit.
I mean, it's not like organizations don't lie. I guess the question here is if the lie comes from the bottom up, from the top, instead of the top down, is it any different?
Yeah, and I mean, certainly organizations have always been extremely susceptible to groupthink of one form or another. I mean, I would imagine if you looked at the internal communications at, say, BlackBerry over the last 10 years, there are probably, you know, a lot of them that are just, hey, everything's great, future's looking good. And so, like, even the kind of, like, innocuous way, like, any organization is highly at risk for that. So I would imagine that it's not even so much that, like, the current, like, the newer system social collaboration side didn't even change it that much, but it's like now there's just a new venue for companies to lie to themselves, essentially.
And the last few weeks has proved to me why I never had a Facebook account. This has been great. I haven't had to upset anyone by unfollowing them, unfriending them, you know, not a lot of other things I could have done, but I'm not in that, so I'm isolated from it. So I'm on Twitter, but that's all I really see and hear. But you know, Lisa's lamented the last few a few times in the last couple of months about that. And I think she got to the point where she actually deleted Facebook off some of her devices because she was so upset.
Yeah, it can get pretty miserable on there sometimes. I mean, for the most part, you know, I guess I fall into these semi echo chamber thing myself, because most of my friends are not sharing the worst things, but I've got a few, you know, Trump voting friends, and I've got a few Democratic friends sharing Occupy Democrat stuff, and it infuriates me.
Right. Yeah. He's but, my cat. He's my kids. He's my political viewpoints.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah. So at least in those cases, you can do some stuff saying like hide all from this post, but it's certainly, or hide all from this source, but it's certainly all the more effective to just not sign up in the first place, probably.
We just need to go back to sharing cat videos.
That part I'm all on board for. So that's
I think
great.
We have our title.
Well, I don't know if either of you, I guess, and Jesse, you probably do follow Marco Arment, the Apple tech blogger and podcaster. He's kind of sharing many, many dog photos right now as kind of the antidote to the election coverage. And it is a refreshing change for sure, but you can overdo that too. So much so that the guys behind Tweetbot are suggesting putting in a flag within their platform to kind of block him from doing so. One thing I did want to point us towards is a really good blog post on Medium by Jeff Jarvis, again a podcaster and blogger and well-known journalist, and he's put together kind of almost a manifesto for cooperation against fake news, and in there's I don't know, 10, a little bit more, actually 15 points in terms of how you might overcome the fake news. And I think that's a really good post for folks to read, just in terms of some of the ideas around how to do this. And one of the points he raises is that actually we don't necessarily want the social media sites to be, to be managing this, because otherwise you're going to get, folks like Facebook putting their own political bias on top of this. It needs to be more independent than that. And also a way of bringing in, or breaking the echo chamber. And I think this is as big a problem, if not bigger than the whole Facebook thing, is how do you make sure you're seeing viewpoints outside of your own, particular kind of political bias or technical bias or whatever it might be, without, offending people at the same time. And I think, there's some really good points in there. It might be worth folks reading and just seeing how they feel about those.
Yeah, I mean, I admittedly did not read the whole thing, but I did skim over it a bit, and I certainly sympathize with the notion of like the companies like Facebook and Twitter trying to like whether or not we want them to manage it, and I understand like why they don't want to manage it. I mean, Twitter got into a bit of a kerfuffle recently by banning a couple high popularity alt-right accounts. Facebook had previously gone the opposite route by getting rid of their top trending news or whatever it was, their editorial team there, which made it really terrible. But like I sympathize where it's like it's much easier for both of these companies and much safer to just say like, look, we are a neutral carrier. You know, all we do is provide people the service, and then they can use it how they will. But but then on the other hand, like you guys mentioned earlier with Facebook, they sell advertisement on the notion that people will be influenced by their service. So it's not like they can pretend that there is no potential for influence there. And I also, I get the kind of like free speech argument where it's like they don't want to, violate people's rights. But conversely, there's, free speech does not mean that any given company has to host anything on their servers if they don't want to host it. And that's what Facebook and Twitter are. So it's definitely fraught because, easily and, just as a general approximation, tech companies are probably more liberal than they are conservative. And so I can definitely see the worry where, if Facebook and Twitter start exercising real editorial control, it will be in favor of liberals. And so it's definitely extremely difficult, but everything those companies do is extremely difficult, and it's not impossible to do this in kind of a, forthright, transparent, honest way. Like it doesn't have to be, Apple style, just do what you do and then don't tell anybody why you did it kind of thing. Like it can be much more open, and I feel like there is room there for kind of a like a really well done process for saying, hey, we're going to, when there's real objective consensus that something is fake news or even propagandistic, if there was a way to deal with that or at least try or to start on that process, like it doesn't have to be, once and done kind of thing, just something. There is definitely room for that. And, there are definitely potential huge problems, but not doing that is not exactly tenable, I feel.
And it's an easy litmus test. You are a media organization if you live stream NFL games. Okay, so topic two.
Well, it goes alongside actually what we've just been discussing, in that one of the kind of notable things of the last week or so was is how kind of relatively unimportant news. I'm thinking of the Hamilton theatre kind of criticism all went around that, all that went around that, how that kind of, overlaid some of the more important stuff, around who was being picked to be part of the transition team, that kind of thing. And the same thing is true in the UK with some burying of bad news, I think, in terms of the bill being passed over the weekend. It's a brand new Investigatory Powers Act in the UK, which is the toughest security bill that's been passed so far, anti-privacy bill, in terms of it giving a whole range of tools for snooping and hacking to the security services in the UK. And it's really worrying. And it's being passed with very little fanfare in the UK, very little coverage. Certainly mainstream media has done an appallingly bad job of covering this. There are a few articles in some of the broadsheet newspapers, but very little on TV. And I just wondered how you guys felt about this, looking from the outside, as I have been on the election. I've been looking from the outside and trying to take an independent perspective. How have you guys felt about some of these new powers being passed in the UK and in Europe?
Well, it has been super secret. You're not wrong there. I mean, it's got almost no coverage over here. I follow the Register quite a lot, so I've seen it build up over time over there. And I would say, I think having a foot in both worlds, I think there was definitely a difference in the UK from the standpoint of the citizens over there, understanding that, some surveillance is allowed, mainly because of the IRA campaigns in the 80s, 70s, 80s and 90s. And then, some terrorist activity in, a handful of years ago. So I think we've been used to that in the UK. And I think this just takes up whatever has already been kind of honestly quite a surveillance state up another, exponential level. It's quite scary when you read into it that, I saw a quote a few days ago that said, using SSL encrypted sites may actually be illegal under this law. I don't know if it is or not. This could be fake news. So, hey, look at me purveying fake news. But if it is, that's kind of shocking that they can take it to that level. And I don't think you can legislate something like that.
Yeah, and I feel like that's a potential trouble, or that is a recurring trouble, really, with any of these kind of either legislative or, as with the case with the NSA, kind of, let's say, outside of legislation processes, where they'll take some kind of like some non-technical view and then turn that into a rule, whether or not it's active. So, like, making encryption itself trouble. Like, there was a quote going around, I believe it was one of Trump's potential appointees saying that, just using encryption may be a red flag. And, this is not a, in the US, it's not a strictly Republican thing, because, under Obama, with all of the actual NSA stuff, the people working for him went around and were basically implying that any kind of secure activity online or any of these things is suspicious, and kind of walking the line of, they individually may or may not know better technically. Like, they could be non-technical people and are just being misinformed by people below them or misinterpreting it, or they may know what they mean and are banking on most people not knowing that, HTTPS is an extremely common thing, or, there's nothing wrong with encrypting email with GPG or any of these other, any number of things. And so it's kind of like these things sneak in as sort of, the public doesn't know any better. So we're going to say these things are kind of shady, and they might sound shady if all you hear is from, so-and-so in charge of a security division. And then, unfortunately, what it leads to this kind of thing where it's like it gets easy for a government to just say, like, hey, look, we want to, protect you from terrorists. So we're going to, assert that all companies have to give us, encryption keys or what have you. And it's and that's a tough one.
And just look at Edward Snowden quote. It's in the show notes in that Guardian article where Edward Snowden says, quote, the UK has just legalized the most extreme surveillance in the history of a Western democracy. It goes further than many autocracies. I think about sums it up, honestly.
Hmm. Yeah.
And there's another piece in that article, actually, where it says that a lot of these powers have actually been used unlawfully by MI5 and the GCHQ and so on over the last few years. And actually, there was court case against them where it was ruled that that was illegal. I think it was last year, maybe early on this year. And so basically their response to that has been to actually go and get it through Parliament in terms of making it lawful. And so, you know, it sounds like one way or another, these agencies are going to, you know, get away with this. And that, you know, maybe the positive of this is that actually it is now written down in law what is allowed and what isn't. Although I guess they're always going to find, you know, grey areas where they're going to overstep those kind of marks. I think one thing, again, bringing it back to enterprise tech, is that companies in Europe and in the UK have been very careful over the last 5 years or so about storing their data in the US, you know, with the Patriot Act and everything else. And you know, that's been one of the things that vendors like IBM and, you know, and the other cloud vendors have had to overcome, is to provide non-US based servers to host this stuff on, you know, whether it's in Netherlands or somewhere else that's nearby. And I looking at this, it feels a lot like the UK has kind of now gone past the US with some of these powers. And I don't know, I haven't seen any clear analysis of whether that's the case, but I do wonder whether that's now going to push companies to actually look at other areas of the world to store their data in versus, you know, keeping it in the UK or putting it in the US.
It does seem like that would be the next logical conclusion. It's almost like between Brexit and this, you know, the UK are trying to shoot some businesses out of their purview of, you know, tax space. It's kind of strange.
Well, and on the plus side for companies and hosting and like hosting and also technologies in general, you know, an advantage of all of this, you know, especially post Snowden coming to light, is that it kind of pushes companies to be more secure by default, to worry more about where the data is housed, and, you know, or in Apple's case, like how the data is stored on the phone or encryption on by default. And it becomes much more of a, you know, a public issue where, like, if, you know, if as citizens of these various countries, we cannot have our will, you know, voting does not get our will done, at least, you know, we can vote with money when it comes to the services we buy. And that is at least effective in that, you know, these things are getting better. You know, encryption technology is getting easier and more pervasive. And, you know, there is benefit to that. And, you know, I'm certainly more aware of where data is housed. You know, that's a U.S. national. There's not that much I can do about it. But it's definitely something that that is much more, that it's easier to be conscious about, which is good, you know, regardless of this individual specifics. Like, improving these things is a win.
I think so. And yeah, it also provides even more business for security consultants. You know, I think this is getting a more and more difficult area, more complex, and therefore consultants and partners that have the knowledge of how this is going to work are going to be even more important. I think the other thing is it kind of discriminates against those that are less tech, you know, conversant, you know, particularly in the consumer world, in that, yeah, there's ways of getting around this, aren't there? You know, using Tor or VPNs or other forms of encryption. You know, Volker Weber posted an article, which we'll link to again in the show notes, about using a different form of instant messaging to again, you know, keep everything encrypted end to end. So there's ways of avoiding falling into this trap, but it's the folks that are less up with the news or less you know, tech savvy that are going to fall into the trap of getting their stuff read. So I guess we just need to keep on top of it. And I will look out for more detailed news articles that come in the following weeks in terms of outlining the impact on businesses, and make sure we share those in the show notes. I'm sure we'll discuss them in future episodes as well.
And it goes to show as well that we don't necessarily have to worry about the 400-pound people in the basement. It's the nations here that are coming after you.
This episode of WTF Tech is sponsored by DJI. DJI is the leader in developing and manufacturing innovative drone and camera technology for commercial and recreational use. In consumer drones, DJI is well over 70% of the global market. The company is dedicated to making aerial photography and filmmaking equipment and platforms more reliable and easier to use for creators and innovators around the world. DJI's revolutionary products and solutions have been chosen by customers in over 100 countries for applications in film, advertising, construction, firefighting, farming, and many other industries. You may well have seen DJI's devices used by vloggers and filmmakers on YouTube, where DJI's Phantom and Mavic drones were responsible for so many of those fantastic overhead and sweeping panorama shots, and the Osmo handheld gimbal mounts are used to smooth handheld and mobile footage. DJI currently have special offers available on much of their range, with a saving of $200 available on the famous DJI Phantom 4 drone. Get more detail on this and DJI's other offers by visiting wtftech.fm/DJI. We thank DJI for their support of the WTF Tech podcast. So on episode one of WTF Tech, we discussed some of those big tech announcements and keynotes that took place 2 or 3 weeks ago. By the way, thanks to everybody who gave us some feedback on Twitter and you recommended our podcast to others and so on. We do appreciate your support on that. But we discussed the Apple event and in particular the new MacBooks in quite a bit of detail. And one of the things that came out of that announcement really was the new MacBook Pros going to fully USB-C and dropping a lot of their quote legacy ports, whether it's USB-A or the SD card slot or some of the old Thunderbolt ports and so on. And it's certainly been lukewarm feedback from a lot of folks in the market. Although I do know actually this week when the embargo has been lifted and folks have actually reviewed these machines in a bit more detail, it does seem to be a bit more of a positive spin. Jesse, I know you follow the Apple news. What's your perspective on how those reviews have come out?
The reviews of the MacBooks themselves, I think, are generally good. Most of the concern I've seen from the start and since then is kind of the for meta reasons, like about what does this mean for pros or, you know, what is Apple's direction here? But like the machines themselves look really good. I may end up, down the line getting one of the Touch Bar ones. As far as like the USB-C connectivity thing, there's definitely, especially depending on what you do, if you're the kind of person who plugs in a lot of stuff regularly to your laptop right now, it's probably more hassle. But if you are, even in my case, when I travel my laptop, there are a few things that I plug in directly, but mostly I have the power cord and it doesn't matter what the connection there is, other than MagSafe being nice, but like that is the power cord. Or there'll be, a lot of the time it'll be projectors. And in that case, I'm already carrying around 3 dongles just in case. So, it's par for the course there. We're kind of already living in a dongly world. This certainly exacerbates it if you already have kind of a workflow, but it's kind of, in this case, it's like, well, these ports do really cover everything. And so, having 4 ports that cover everything is in general nicer than having 2 ports that cover everything and then also a power port and a, old style USB or a Thunderbolt or something like that. Dongles are a bit of a hassle, but that's not new. The hope is, I guess, in 5 years, we won't need dongles for everything. And hopefully USB-C will stick around for a while, because it's clearly intended to be, even more universal than USB was initially. So here's hoping. But like the machines themselves, as far as I can tell, seem pretty great. And I kind of want one.
Donglegate. Did you see the tweet the other day? I don't know who it was, where he needed to do a hardware gigabit connection. And the only way to do it was to get a gigabit to Lightning and then Lightning to USB-C. So he had 2 dongles to get one thing done.
And that's one of my concerns, is we seem to be doing everything we can to lighten our load in terms of having thinner, lighter machines, and yet you then start adding on all this extra weight in terms of dongles and then maybe a case to put your dongles in. And it feels like we're kind of eroding the benefits out of a lot of this new tech. I do share your perspective, Jesse, in that I think in 2 or 3 years' time, we're going to have forgotten about this Ferrari and we're all going to be used to using USB-C as long as it does stick around. Certainly looking back at previous generations of MacBook Pros and so on that I've owned, I'm not using any of those ports anymore. So much has moved to Wi-Fi and Bluetooth or up into the cloud and back down again or whatever, that it's not a concern anymore, all of those ports. So I think that will go away. I do kind of wish that Apple would ship a kind of universal dongle that had most of the ports you might need. And I know there's third parties that are doing this, but I just trust the Apple ones a little bit more. Maybe a dongle that would give you USB-A, SD card, VGA, HDMI or something all on one device. So you're not carrying around 4 or 5 dongles and potentially losing them places. But I think the issue will go away over time. And as you say, the reviews have been, generally pretty good. I still feel like the space for a 17-inch MacBook Pro, I think that may well come back at some stage. I think that real high-end pros machine is completely missing from the Mac lineup at some stage. No, I think that may come back, but for the moment, for 90% of the pro population, I think the MacBook Pro is going to do a fairly good job.
And haven't you just described a pot replicator as opposed to a dongle?
Yeah, quite possibly, but it needs to be mobile. It needs to be carried around. But yeah, you're
put
right.
On wheels.
I mean that's the way other companies, whether it's Lenovo with ThinkPads or whatever, have had it, isn't it? Is a dock that you can drop your laptop into, and it gives you all of that stuff. Yep. When you're at your desk. I think actually the desk stuff is kind of going away, because USB-C will do all of that for you. You can have one USB connection from your monitor or whatever that provides power and connectivity for everything else, and then you plug all your other things into your monitor. I think that model is going to work well. It's what's going to happen if you're working at a coffee shop and need to get photos of your camera or something. That's a more tricky problem to solve.
You're taking photos at coffee shops? This is why we need surveillance, people.
And a couple of things you mentioned in there, like the 17-inch or any number of the other kind of, everything being thin and light restriction, is that gets to some of the, like I was mentioning, the meta worry about Apple's direction here, which is that, for example, there's a big to-do about the 16 gig limit, and people saying, oh, well, it's not Apple imposing that. That's this, because they're using this chip, they can only, this specifically, low power but high performance one doesn't support 32 gig, which, fair enough. That is true. But it gets to the concern that it's like, well, nobody is forcing Apple to use only the thin and light options. Like nobody other than Apple basically is saying that they all have to be completely focused on thinness and lightness. And, certainly there, it makes, I think, the most sense to do that in general. But there are laptops that are more powerful, that have better video cards, that have more RAM, have faster processors. They're not svelte. They're not necessarily, they don't necessarily get as good battery life. But none of the restrictions are, absolutely required. I mean, I guess they're good for Apple style focus, but Apple used to be able to also focus on the higher end. And certainly I think we talked about this on the desktop on the last podcast. But it's all kind of it helps the narrative, I guess, of Apple not really caring about the high end, where, it makes sense that they don't, because their primary concern, their primary moneymaker is the iPhone. So, they could drop the entire Mac line and still be extraordinarily profitable. But, even on the Mac side, the vast majority of people don't care if the Mac Pro exists or if there's a 17-inch MacBook Pro or whatever. But but a lot of people do, and a lot of people who care about computers do. I've been an Apple guy forever, but I would be more excited about Apple if there was a cool Mac Pro, even if I didn't get it, or if there was a, I used to use a 17-inch MacBook Pro. It was heavy, but it was nice, and I like having those options. And it's cool as a computer person, especially because, as a programmer, I can't use iOS devices for my work. I can just physically cannot, unless I remote desktop in, and it's miserable. But I need to use a Mac, and the fact that the Mac line is kind of compressing, and while being still quite good, they have essentially eliminated a lot of the higher end stuff. It's like, well, that's okay. Like I can still do my work, but it's not as good as it potentially could be if they weren't putting these constraints on themselves.
Well, eventually a Mac's just going to be a USB-C port.
Yeah, you can plug in your video card, and you can plug in your external ports.
the only way to find it is going to be the dongles. You got to follow the dongles back to your actual computer.
It's like a rat king of dongles is your computer.
My desk right now.
And guys, what do you think about the Touch Bar? I mean, I've only had 5 minutes play with it in an Apple store, and it certainly seems pretty powerful, and it's going to be very interesting to see how software vendors start to support it and how much consistency we have of user interface and so on. I think we're only going to see how this plays out maybe over 3 or 6 months as we go forward. But again, taking it back to enterprise tech, can you see, for example, IBM or Oracle or whatever using the touch bar to support some of their client apps? Can you see that taking off?
I can see Adobe doing it. I think beyond that, it would be Mac only. I can't see... You know, maybe Microsoft, if they want to do something with the Office suite on the Mac, but it becomes it's a very thin segment inside of the enterprise. That's a very thin segment, right? So Macs are probably 8 to 13% of enterprise. Macs with the touch bar would be, you know, less than 1% for the foreseeable future. I think that's a hard sell.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like in most cases, there'd be very little to be gained. I mean, I guess like anything that uses function keys currently, like if you're using database software that makes use of, you know, for example, F9 or something, having a touch bar replacement, you know, would make sense. But in a lot of cases, these are not exactly companies that are whole hog adopting the latest macOS technologies to begin with. Or even sometimes necessarily running on the latest version until 6 months later. So I would be very surprised if a lot of kind of enterprise software ends up supporting an extra cool peripheral on a small slice of their supported platform. But you know, but certainly, yeah, like somebody like Adobe could. I figure anybody who's invited up for an Apple keynote will have some demo to show. And I would imagine that some companies maybe may enjoy that opportunity. But as far as like the actual day-to-day work, I would be surprised if that. And I mean, for now, it's to be seen whether even like actual whole hog Apple supporting companies really jump on this. I suspect a lot of them will, like, you know, companies like Panic and stuff, I would imagine, are going to do a good job. But other ones, I feel like it may be more of a mixed bag, even in, you know, real professional workflows using the Mac, but we'll see.
I think a lot depends on whether they release a touch bar for desktops as well. I mean, you know, whilst it's only Mac Pros, you're only ever going to get, you know, maybe maximum 30% or something adoption in the Mac line. I think they need to release it as part of an external keyboard, and whether they'll do that or not, I'm not quite sure. It also, I think, plays into the whole Apple, you know, Apple's end goal is always to sell Apple systems rather than to provide widespread adoption of technology. And I think if it had been, you know, IBM, Microsoft or whatever, that come up with this technology and then provided an external peripheral that supported it, you know, they'd be trying to go for really widespread use to then try and drive their technology forward. And I think, you know, that's always going to be the problem. Unless Apple you know, partners with other vendors to get this technology into their machines, you're only ever going to get, as Darren was saying, maybe 2 to 8% or something of the market, and therefore it's only going to be limited adoption. And it's only where you have significant numbers of users that are using Apple in a particular you know, situation that you're going to get vendors wanting to rush to support it. I do think it's interesting seeing how widely adoption of Macs is taking place in IBM now, whether IBM do prioritize this, you know, more than they would maybe 5 years or so ago. But again, we're only going to see once that plays out. This episode is sponsored by Backblaze. Backblaze is an online backup service that allows Windows and macOS users to backup their data to an offsite data center. Full and limited cloud-based backup costs just $5 per machine per month, and it covers all your external attached hard drives, even large storage arrays like Drobo's. If you're worried about protecting your home machines or those of your family and friends, Backblaze is a great solution for that need. However, what you may not be aware of is that Backblaze has launched a full business-grade service in the last year or so and offers a centralized management panel for all your backups, including full permission control for management of your data and your restores. It works fantastically on laptops and desktops and is a perfect fit for small to medium businesses. Because all of the data is held off-site, it protects your organization against not just hardware failures and corruptions, but also any kind of location-based disaster, fire, flood, or major communications outage. If the worst happens and you need to restore significant quantities of data, you can download the data over the internet, or Backblaze will ship you a restore on either USB flash or USB hard drive to make that recovery even easier. Starting from just 5 machines, Backblaze is the only service that provides unlimited backup for only $50 per year per computer. That's unlimited data, unlimited file size, unlimited backup speeds, unlimited file types, and unlimited external drives. Is it time for you to stop worrying about your own tapes, backup schedules, and offsite storage? Take a look at Backblaze Business Backup today. Go to wtftech.fm/backblaze for more details. We thank Backblaze for their support of the WTF Tech podcast. Also on the enterprise tech side, following the Microsoft announcement around the desktop stuff, we discussed the studio machine last time we met. There was also an announcement last week around Microsoft Teams, which is their new kind of Slack killer app, you know, team collaboration as part of the Office 365 platform. So it's very much IM chat based on groups. Have you guys had a chance to have a look at this yet, seeing whether you think it's going to be relevant to some of your customers?
We're 30 years in and people are still looking for the collaboration killer. Mm. That's a sad, damning condemnation on these enterprise software vendors. And the fact that they're all copying a startup in aka Slack makes it even worse. You know, how did they not all see this coming?
Particularly as they've had IM platforms in the past, which they're now rushing to abandon to come up with something new, it seems, yeah. You know. Microsoft has had a couple of goes, haven't they? They've had Link, well, they've had more than that. They've probably had 10 goes at IM, but you know, certainly in the last couple of years, they've had Link, which then became Skype for Business, and you know, and they've got Skype itself, and now they're doing this. Same with IBM, you know, moving away from the same time to do Watson Workspace. You know, it does feel like they're asking, and I think we may have discussed this previously, you know, they're asking us to trust them again with another collaboration technology when the previous ones haven't necessarily worked as well as they might have done. And maybe that's another string to Slack's bow, really, is that because they're coming at this for the first time, people can trust them and believe that this thing's going to be around for a while to come.
And maybe the old ways did work. Maybe these vendors just want to shift more seats of new SKUs.
For sure.
Yeah, and I mean, I haven't looked too much into Microsoft Teams other than just kind of like the overview. I think in part just because I have a bit of Slack knockoff fatigue at this point. like, okay, get it. Like, you guys really want that market. Fine. Because at this point, I kind of just have to take a wait and see approach, which is, well, you know, maybe Watson Workspace will do well. Maybe Microsoft Teams will do well. Maybe they'll just be in the category of, if you are all in on IBM or Microsoft, this is the tool you use because you have a license for it. Or maybe, you know, it could just be that Slack keeps dominating and keeps making inroads. So, you know, Slack has proven a very adept company at this, especially considering it started out as just kind of a small team collaboration thing. And then it took over the world, even in areas where they're not even ostensibly competing. And so it will be kind of interesting to see. I don't have too much interest at this point in like comparing individual ones, just because, like I said, there's so many, and a lot of them are just kind of, if you are already in this vendor sphere, then you'll probably try it out.
And following on from that, I do think that the genius that Microsoft has is bundling already with Office 365 gives it to all of your customers immediately. You know, God knows what the IBM licensing is going to be like when it comes out. You know, it'd be easy to put a man on Mars and figure that out. And Slack, the second part of this thought chain I was going on is, I'm surprised no one has bought Slack.
I think they've turned people down. I mean, but by all accounts, Microsoft tried to buy them before they developed Teams, and they were turned down. So I think Slack are in it for the long run. Yeah, indeed. And we've seen plenty of other companies go through that and end up, you know, not so well in the future. So it'll be interesting. I think, you know, that whole bundling with Office is an intriguing thing, because so many companies have Office 365 licenses. In my experience, few of them are actually using the power of Office 365. Many of them are just, you know, have shifted from Office on-prem, you know, box licensing to Office 365, because that was just the most sensible way of doing the licensing and the support, not because they wanted the value of cloud-based or collaboration-based platforms. And I think the challenge Microsoft have got is, yes, there's, you know, many, many companies that have now got licenses for Team as part of their Office, but how many of them are actually deploying? How many of them are actually using? You know, if anything, if Yammer, for example, is anything to go by, very, very few companies are really using Yammer and Angular, even if they're licensed for it.
But the counterpoint to that is, when someone in my organization comes in and says, hey, I've seen Slack, it's great, we need it, the core collaboration team can say, well, we've already got, to coin Jesse's term, a Slack knockoff. Here you go. Why would we purchase it? And I think that may be, you know, where Slack eventually gets kicked in the you know, Short and Curly's from a revenue standpoint is, yes, you know, you may not see a lot of people use it, but the new people who are going to it may already have something synonymous. And that's how Microsoft get you, right? Microsoft have always been the Taiwan of the software industry. They don't invent crap. They just build it better, cheaper, faster.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have a, you know, 100% success rate on that, and especially in recent years. But, you know, being the vendor that's giving you this product for the system you already have, done right, is an extremely strong position. So basically, they're coming into it, you know, while you know, Microsoft and IBM and so forth are behind Slack as far as existing for this product, they do have those potential built-in advantages of bundling. We'll see how much, you know, how much that works.
And Teams is already gold, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought I saw it on my Office 365 account the other day. I thought it was in there.
Yeah, it's I think it's available to all Office 365 licensees. I think it also comes back to the whole kind of IT versus shadow IT discussion, is that, you know, in that scenario you just outlined, Darren, where, you know, a business team needs some way of you know, chatting with each other, collaborating. The question is, do they just go and find something themselves? In which case, they can go to the Slack website, you know, register a team up and running in 10 minutes, you know, and off they go doing it themselves. Or do they go to IT and say, oh, have you got something to solve this problem for us? And IT then saying, well, we've got Office 365, let's deploy Teams for you. And that's kind of, to me, the new way versus the old way. And of course, it's sweeping generalization, but I'm not sure too many business teams really have any passion for going to IT and say, solve the problem for me, if they've got an easy way of doing this themselves. And so I think that's where Slack has won, is you've had these little pockets that have just got themselves off the ground themselves, you know, completely self-fulfilled their own requirement. And you know, it's only then when they're 3 months in and they've already got a very vibrant team collaboration platform that then IT hear about it and then, you know, want to take control of that. So, you know, that maybe goes against the office model, where actually you need to go to IT to say, can you provision this for us?
From this standpoint, I think it's a corporate IT security problem, not necessarily an IT problem. You know, again, a lot of these regulated compliance industries, right, you don't want your data just going anywhere. And I think that's kind of the key, is if some of these industries were to see you were using Slack, mm-hmm. the hammer would come down pretty quick. And, you know, it's interesting that you just outlined the way Microsoft will lose is exactly the way Yammer did it at the beginning as well.
Yeah.
With sign up, it's free. Well, it's not. But it was initially.
Well, that's certainly an interesting conversation. And I'm sure we'll return to the whole shadow versus, you know, corporate IT again in future podcasts. But it's certainly be interesting to watch how Teams evolves and how it's taken off, and maybe we need to return to that again in a month or so and see whether we have any customers that are looking at it in any more detail. So that brings us to the end of the topics we wanted to cover today. As we mentioned on the last episode, we're going to offer tips at the end of each one of these WTF Tech shows. And so, Darren, do you want to kick us off? What's your tip for today?
As everyone has noticed, I sound really sexy right now.
You do.
Yes. The svelte tones of Darren's not English, not American accent coming through at 192 kilohertz. So why am I mentioning this? Well, my tip is a Yeti microphone. A couple of weeks ago, someone whose name that rhymes with Uwe Akintyre had complained that my microphone was a bit clicky. So... Unfortunately, Lisa said I could go and buy whatever I wanted, and I don't think she realized what was going to happen. So I have a Yeti microphone on a boom and a pop screen. I think I tweeted a picture of it on Friday when we were originally scheduled to do this podcast. So that's my tip. It's not cheap. Actually, it was way cheaper than I thought. It was about $129 for a microphone, but by the time you get everything else, it adds up. But it is a really impressive piece of kit, I've got to say. I'm kind of... I feel like a radio DJ. I feel like I should be doing like the top 40 or something.
And we will put that photo in the show notes, because it looks very professional. I have to say, you got a really nice anti-shock mount there and everything, and you've done a good job of putting that together, and you sound fantastic, Darren. So thanks for doing that for us.
And I look amazing.
We'll hold off on the whole video podcast for a while. Jesse, what's your tip?
So my tip is, it's a very specific audience, which is Domino developers doing Java development in Eclipse. So for the handful of you that exist at this point, it's about the new version of the XPages SDK that Sardar Ashime, I think, I apologize, Sardar, he has done the legwork to make it so that you can use this on the Mac, which has, you know, improved my life surprisingly in the last couple of weeks, because now I can just use Mac Eclipse along with, you know, and develop Domino things alongside all of the other work that I've been doing, which is primarily on the Mac. I still need to have Windows so I can actually, you know, run Domino, but having it in here rather than having a second Domino or Eclipse workspace in Windows, you know, getting nicer fonts, everything looks a little better on the Mac side. It is very delightful for my day-to-day work, and anybody else who's doing this kind of plugin development on Domino should definitely give it a shot. I believe it's currently just on the OpenNTF stash. It'll probably be on the OpenNTF project page before too long if it's not currently. We'll include a link in the show notes for that.
And Jesse will be adding a touch bar for that shortly.
Yeah, kudos to Sardar for doing that. And it's fantastic. I mean, I've stepped away a little bit from OpenNTF, having been on the board a few years ago. And it's great to hear not only that there's still activity there, but some really clever things are being developed that are making a big difference to the development community. So, yeah, kudos to everybody that's involved in OpenNTF for carrying this forward.
Some more props to Sardar. He actually did the Bootstrap environment that's on my blog, on the Domino blog.
Yeah. And still looking really good. So my tip for today is actually a development platform of its own right. It's Workflow, which is an iOS app, which you may not have come across, but it's designed as a really simple and easy to use automation framework for iOS. So it kind of reminds me a lot of the early days of Notes in terms of allowing business folks, you know, non-technical folks to put together very simple applications, automations to get things done, you know, to make their lives easier and then make themselves more productive. It's a really cheap app. It's only £2.29 in the UK, $2.99. And basically, you have a whole series of default actions in the application that you can drag and drop into your own workflows. It does looping. You've got some basic expressions in there. You can manage variables. And through all of that, you can start pulling together social applications, productivity applications on your iOS device. You can look at RSS feeds on websites, and you can together wrap all that into some quite neat little workflows. So just some simple ones that I've been working on in the last couple of weeks is just, for example, to when you want to post a video to your blog, you know, from YouTube or somewhere, a little workflow that goes away and grabs the thumbnail for that video and uploads it automatically into your WordPress blog. Really simple stuff, but very, very powerful. And for somebody like me that now works pretty much full time on the iPad, really does save a huge amount of time. There's some really nice workflows that are out there you can just download from other folks. There's a new version of Workflow this week that includes an improved gallery of workflows you can download, or else you can just search for them on the web. And I'll also have a tip here for another podcast, which is Canvas. It's a Relay FM podcast. We'll have the link in the show notes, hosted by Federico Vitici and Fraser Spears. And they've just done a series of podcasts on how to use Workflow and how it might be used to improve your kind of work life. So we'll have links for those in the show notes. But the tip is Workflow. Have either of you guys used Workflow? I imagine it's up your street, isn't it, Jesse?
$2.99 for development environment. That's a cheap buy-in right there.
Yeah.
I haven't used it, but I've definitely heard, you know, it's one of those things where if you can do your work on iOS, then Workflow is a critical part of it. So I would imagine that if I was able to do more on my iPad, I would absolutely be using that.
And I love it because it's fairly intelligent. It does some stuff like if you pass it input, it automatically works out what type of variable you want to set it to. It doesn't kind of ask too many questions in terms of setting some of this stuff up in detail configuration. It just goes, oh, you're passing me a web page. You want an image, therefore I'll save it as an image in my variable. So really neat stuff. And for somebody like me who's more of a hacker than a programmer, it works really well to help me get my stuff done.
Hacker in the good way, dear surveillance.
Yes, yeah, if anybody's listening. So that brings us to the end of today's show. How do folks find you on the web, Darren?
blog.darrenduke.net or Darren Duke, all one word, on Twitter, although you might want to avoid my Twitter account until sometime after January 21st.
Jesse?
I'm at prostilic.us for my blog. At some point, I will return to blogging there. It's been a little while, but not too long. But I do have a couple queued up. I've just been quite busy. On Twitter, I am Gidgerby. Like I mentioned earlier, I've been trying to restrain a bit on the political side of my tweeting with mild success. So if you don't want to hear about that at all, mute me for a couple more weeks. I'm trying to restrain a little bit.
Did a good job. And I am Stuart McIntyre. You can find me on Twitter, Stuart McIntyre, and my blog is at stuart-mcintyre.com. So thanks for listening to episode 2 of WTF Tech. Hope you've enjoyed it. We really love your feedback. We would love to get a bit of a feedback loop going. So if you have any follow-up for us, anything you'd like us to discuss, any additional information you want to share that we can include in the follow-up next week, please post it to the website at wtftech.fm reply to us on Twitter. But that's all for today. Enjoy the show, and we'll speak to you again in a couple of weeks' time. Bye for now.
Boop, beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop.
You do that very well, Darren. It's very consistent. It's exactly
it's all ad-lib. What can I say? It's like my life. It's just whatever happens at that time. Do we get computers in prison camps?
I mean, I think we'll be fine. Figured I don't know. Male, I'll be fine for a little while.
I don't know if it looks if Donald Trump uses the IBM sentiment analyzer against my tweets. If I disappear, that's where I'm at. We actually kept it under an hour because we didn't start till like 4 minutes past, right?
Yeah.
I think that might be a record ever on any podcast.
We did have some short ones on Twill.
Must have been when it was just IBM as a guest.
Yeah, exactly. When Sandy was on.
Yeah, I was sick those days.